gone quarter past, so I thought if we start the session, because we've got four papers today. So just so you all know, welcome to the Ascot Symposium. Now's your chance to leave if you've come to the wrong session. We're going to have four presentations, so it's an organised session, but I thought before we begin, it would be useful to give those of you that aren't familiar with the Ascot Toolkit a brief overview of what Ascot is and the different kinds of toolkits that are available. What I will do is I'll give you a very, very brief sort of top-level overview, and then I'll hand over to the presenters, and after each presentation we'll have time for questions. And of course we'll be available in the tea and coffee break if anyone wants to follow up with us afterwards. So, what is ASCOT? It stands for the Adult Social Care Outcomes Toolkit. And it's actually a collection of different instruments for measuring service user outcomes. We've got, and some of these instruments will be referred to by the presenters today. So you might hear about people talking about a self-completion toolkit, which we call SCT4, and there's also one called SCT3. And what that stands for is self-completion, and then there's a 3 and a 4, which represent the number of outcome states, and I will talk to you a bit more about that in a moment. There's an interview version, which we call INT4, and more recently we've now got a carer's version of that interview, so that's the Ascot Carer INT4, and that will be discussed in more detail later on in the session. And we also have a mixed methods version for residential care, which we call CH3, which stands for care homes 3, because there's 3 outcome states in each domain. I'll talk to you a little bit about that. And Nick is going to be drawing on some of the work that we've done using that toolkit in his presentation later on. So what ASCOT does as a collection of toolkits is it measures what we call social care related quality of life, which is quality of life in regards to the way in which social care can affect your quality of life. So we've designated different domains, which I will explain in a moment, that we think are the most pertinent to social care. Social care can have an impact or greatest impact on. And these are the 8 domains, and they've been developed over a number of projects over a series of years. We have personal cleanliness and comfort, food and drink, safety, and clean and comfortable accommodation. And these are what we call, they're grouped together, because these are what we call the basic order domain. So they're coming in things that you need for your for a healthy life, and without which you would very soon have health consequences. And then we have what we call the higher order domain. So this is social participation and involvement, control over daily living and occupation. And then finally, we have dignity, which is slightly different, stands alone from the other domains, because this is tapping into the way in which you were treated by care staff makes you feel about yourself. So we talk about dignity in relation to ASCOT in quite a specific way rather than in a global way. And I think some of the later presentations might touch on that in a bit more detail, and you'll have some opportunity for discussion about that at the end. So there are different outcome states in each of those domains, according to the instrument. So if I mentioned earlier to you that we have some which are called INT4, some called CH3, and I said briefly that the levels, the number, refers to the outcome, number of outcome states in each domain. So where we have a 3, that means that there are, ignore the top one, there are 3 levels, 3 outcome states in each domain. So whether the person has no needs, some needs, or high level needs. And that would be rated, or the person would respond and give their own state for each of those 8 domains. They would say, answer a question, and it would be coded as no needs, some needs, or high level needs. So no needs is the kind of trivial, everyday level needs that would be expected in the area of everyone, everyday life. So you could call that a kind of mustn't grumble. Some needs means that it's sufficiently important or there's enough of them in number that it would affect your everyday quality of life. So these are significant. They do have an impact on your quality of life. It's not insignificant to have some needs. And high-level needs are reserved for those people who whose needs are sufficient enough that it would affect their health. And this can be physical health. And so, for example, in the case of food and drink, you can see how quite quickly having needs in that domain of your life would impact on your physical health. Or it could be psychological health, for example, if you're becoming very isolated and lonely, for example, in social participation. And then where we have the four-level state toolkits, such as the interview version of ASCOT and self-completion version of ASCOT, we also include the ideal state. And this is the individual's wishes and preferences in this aspect of their daily life are fully met. So this is going beyond just having your needs met. It's having your needs met in a way which is in line with your own preferences. So this is trying to capture person-centred care. It's trying to get at where services are going above and beyond for service users. So you have your outcome states for each of those eight domains, and each of those outcome states in each of those domains is preference weighted, and we can talk to people about that at the end if people want to find out more about that. And you can use those scores to calculate. You can use those ratings to calculate three different types of scores. One is called current social care rated quality of life, which is, as I think you would expect, it describes your situation now with services. As you're answering the interview or filling in the questionnaire today, what is your current quality of life? And then we have something which is a little bit different from other quality of life measures, which we call expected social care rated quality of life. And this is where ASCOT is a little bit different from the other kind of outcome measures that are available. And this is trying to get at what you would expect people's life would be like without services, so without formal paid services, help and support. So obviously, sometimes people that we get often get questions, is this easy for people to answer? And we've done a lot of cognitive testing around this area. And what we found is it is easy for people to answer, because actually most people that receive social care services know very well what it's like for services not to turn up. Or they know very well that they would be worried about what would happen if my care worker doesn't come at 7 o'clock tomorrow morning. So actually, when you ask people this question, you say, okay, now imagine you didn't have care and support in this area of your life. What would your life be like? They can answer that, with the exception of people with cognitive impairment. And we can talk a bit more about that if that's of interest to people. And Nick's presentation will touch on that, how we get around that issue. Then using those two scores, we are able to calculate something which we call social care rated quality of gain. And this is trying to get at the impact of the service on the person's life. So you've got their situation now with services, and then you've got their situation without services. And very often, if they didn't have the service and support, their quality, social care rated quality of life would be worse. So you have this situation. And the difference between the two is what we call social care rated quality of life gain. So it gives you a measure of the impact. What is the impact that service is having on that person's quality of life? And that's where ASCOT does something a little bit different to the other measures. So, I know I've given you a lot of top-level information, but I just wanted you to understand, in case those terms are used in people's presentations, and you can follow up, I think, in more detail during the question and answer sessions after each presentation. As I say, Nick and I will be available. And we've got Anne here as well, and Jules, and Camilla at the back, sitting in the middle here, who can all help answer questions if anyone wants to follow up with us on anything specific afterwards. But hopefully, during the course of the presentation, some of this will become clearer to you. We've got a website, ASCOT website, where you can register for free. And once you've registered, you have complete access to all the guidance, the different toolkits, so you can have a really good browse and get a better understanding of that. We also have a really useful reference section now on our website, so that you can look at ways in which we've used it and the tool's been used in academic papers, and also papers that refer to how the toolkit's been developed over time. And we have a Twitter account, so as you are listening to presentations today, please tag us using that @ASCOT_PSSRU so that we can see what people are saying about us. So I will not waste any more time. I'll hand over to our first presenter, which is Professor Julian Forder, who's going to talk to us about using ASCOT in economic evaluations.
Right, thank you very much, and good afternoon. So I'm going to talk a bit about using ASCOT in economic evaluation, and it's great that Anne-Marie did a bit of an overview, so I don't have to go into any of the nuts and bolts of what the ASCOT tool looks like.
Because what I'd rather do is spend some time thinking about how it can be used, and particularly in the context of informing decisions about prioritisation, resource allocation, choice between services, and so on. Usual disclaimer, which you've seen throughout all our presentations, the ones at least funded by the Policy Research Unit. So as I said, what I'd like to do is consider the arguments around the use of ASCOT in economic evaluation. And to break that down a little, to talk firstly about using ASCOT specifically in economic evaluation. And then I thought I might broaden out a little and talk a bit more about the role of economic evaluation using ASCOT in long-term care more generally. So the starting point is, and you'd be not surprised at all to hear it from me as an economist, that I see the world in terms of opportunity cost. So anything you do has an opportunity cost, and ultimately ASCOT and tools like that give you a way to quantify what the opportunity cost of all the things that we do is, and therefore to give us a sense about how we can prioritise, guide our decisions to produce the greatest net benefits. That's what it's all about. And there are three challenges, at least, in doing economic evaluation in long-term care, I would say. The first is pretty fundamental and at sort of conceptual level, and it's a question about, well, what benefits or value do we actually want to see from our long-term care system? What is it that we want it to produce? Having grappled with that question, then we move on to say, well, how can we do that? How can we measure those benefits in practice? And then thirdly, and that's a point that Anne-Marie alluded to with ASCOT, this question about attribution. So if you have a quality of life measure, how can you attribute the effects of the things you do in your care system to changes in care-related quality of life or whatever measure of outcome you use? So to take this first question, well, obviously there's very many different ways you could begin to address this, but I think there are at least a couple of principles which seem relevant to this. First of all, long-term care is inherently person-centred, and so you'd think that the benefits ought to be also related to the person rather than, say, the system. So you don't talk about the system so much, you talk about benefits for the individual in the system, in the care system. And you might also argue that ultimately it's about trying to reduce people's needs and improve their quality of life. Over the years, people have used different terms for this, but generally speaking, a sort of a wrapping up term at the moment, at least certainly in UK thinking, we talk about now improvements in well-being. So your care system is there to try and improve the well-being of people with care needs. And this is now very much a central part of policy. It's clause one of the new 2014 Care Act. So very much at the heart of the new care system. So how can we measure improving well-being? I mean, it's a broad concept. Well, one of the approaches that we use and I will talk about is equating this idea with improved care-related quality of life. And as Anne-Marie has shown us, you can think about quality of life over a range of domains or different dimensions which are particularly relevant to the use of care services. But also for economic evaluation, what we need is a measure which allows us to do comparison. So in some sense, it needs to be a generic measure, or at least it's most valuable when it's a generic measure, and when it's valued in a common currency, so that we can compare a range of different social care interventions. That's where I think it becomes most powerful, because it allows us to make decisions between interventions or activities or uses of our social care budget that can be quite different. And a way to do this is preference weighting. It's not the only way, but it's the one that economists and health economists in particular have been using more recently. So the idea is that you value with reference to an ideal quality of life has to compare to a state of being dead. A quality of life of being dead, which we generally set at zero, for, I think, fairly obvious reasons. And you can make ratings about different quality of life states by comparing how people would trade off between the current quality of life state on the one hand and having a full quality of life but dying earlier on the other. And this method is generally called the time trade-off, or there's other ways you can do it through standard gamble. There's a whole industry of preference solicitation that you can use. So if you use those criteria for what your practical measure would look like, then, and as pointed out in a recent review by Mackay and colleagues, then for long-term care, it really boils down at the moment to a couple of measures, ASCOT and an ICECAP. ICECAP is a capability measure developed mainly by people at Birmingham, Joe Coase and others. I'm going to talk about ASCOT. But you can also, of course, look at the whole phalanx of existing quality of life measures for healthcare, of which EQ5D or the various FS measures, or the whole reams of this whole industry again of measures out there. And perhaps they are relevant. But I'll argue that maybe not always for long-term care. That's not to say there are no issues of this. And with ASCOT and with the other measures that are specific to long-term care, I think. Many of these measures are self-report. I mean, they can be self-report in interview or self-completion directly. And therefore, it's a huge challenge when you're talking about people with cognitive impairment or communication difficulties. And there's now a lot of work going on, mainly in the Quarry programme, I say, just a bit of a plug for our work, around the use of proxy, respondents, observational tools. My colleagues, especially at Ken, are doing some sterling work on that. There also are tensions between, I would say, the comprehensiveness and the sensitivity of your measure. So obviously, if you think about quality of life or well-being, it can be a very broad concept indeed. And so you might want to cast your net widely in that respect. But I would argue that if you do that, then you lose some sensitivity if you're trying to measure the specific effects of long-term care. And a particular issue of mine is that when you're talking about long-term care, you're really focusing much more on the consequences of a condition and managing those consequences rather than the disability or the condition that underlies that. So that really distinguishes between healthcare measures and the measures that we're interested in. And you've got the question about, of course, whose welfare you're talking about. Service user is just part of this process. We've heard from this conference, I think, some great presentations really bringing out the important role of the informal carer in this, or the carer, the caregiver. And so perhaps we should think about the focus, which is different. Attribution is the third thing. As I mentioned, if you have a quality of life measure, and that seems the way to go, the problem is that it's difficult to ensure that you understand how services are impacting any observed change you see in the quality of life measure, and not the whole range of other factors. Now, Anne-Marie talked about the expected value in ASCOT, and I'm not going to talk about that at the moment. I'm going to talk about focusing on how we can do attribution just with the current ASCOT score. So generally speaking, the two methods are, well, you can do experiments, you can do all sorts of experimental designs, RCTs, of course, being some would regard the gold standard for these things. But experimental designs are often involve practical and ethical, particularly ethical barriers. They're clearly very expensive, and in long-term care, that's a big issue. And although they deal with some selection bias issues, they also have other problems, particularly around blinding, where it's very difficult to blind the participants to a social care or a long-term care intervention. And then the second is observational studies. And what I'm going to focus on is an approach that we've been working with for a while, which is a production function approach. And this essentially exploits how observations of care-related quality of life vary with both the intensity of the use of a social care or long-term care intervention and also the range of needs-related characteristics of the individual. I'm going to try and say long-term care, but I will slip into the English use of social care quite a bit because we generally see it as synonymous, although there are some slightly different exact meanings of that term. So this observational approach, how does it work? Well, if you just got some data out there, observed the relationship between the quality of life and, for example, the amount of home care service an older person would receive, then generally you see this negative relationship. Okay, so that doesn't look so good. It seems like the more service you get, the worse the quality of life of the service user. But of course, the reason that happens is that there is a strong correlation between both the reduction in a person's quality of life and the amount of care they get with the severity of their condition. So the greater your level of needs, the more service you get, the greater the level of needs, other things equal, the worse your quality of life is. And so you see that spear risk correlation. If you can look at the relationship between quality of life and the severity of the condition without services, then you'd expect to see an even steeper negative relationship. So the production approach, what it tries to do is control for need. It tries to take the need out of the picture so it has zero effect on quality of life, and that should, in theory, then leave you with the impact that the services make on quality of life. That's the idea. So there you see, once you've done that adjustment, which is really easy, then you've got the gain in social care related quality of life as that results from your service use. So we have tried this a couple of times, and one of the early applications, which was more of a sort of proof of concept rather than a serious attempt to value home care in this case, was to use a smallish study of home care that was based on a follow-up of a national survey. I haven't got time to go into details, but it collected a range of information, particularly for our use, ASCOT, needs variables and service use. You know, I said it's really important to control for need, and obviously in data sets, although you have some indicators of need, you're likely to also not have information on a range of pertinent need factors. So from a statistical modelling point of view, you have this potential problem of omitted needs variables or endogeneity problems, and we tackled this using instrumental variables. And I could go on for hours about how this is done, and you'd be really bored, so I won't. I'll skip over it, but if people want to ask me later on, then we'll work into it. This is what we found, broadly speaking. So these are our production functions. So this is the intensity of home care that people receive, and these are the production functions of their improved quality of life. And the red line and the green line are showed that confidence interval ranges. The blue line is the point estimate. So you can see it's a positive relationship, which is good. Generally speaking, the more people receive home care, the more their quality of life has improved. Now, this kind of analysis is quite helpful when you want to address policy questions about the optimal or the best intensity of service use. If you're a decision maker and you're tasked with the question of how much home care should we supply to people with certain characteristics, these kinds of analysis can help you quite a lot. So what we found, if you compare two groups, and we split the sample between the high ADL group and the low and moderate group, high group received more services than the low group. But what we found in the margin, so if you increase from their average package, their home care by 1 hour, then what we found was actually there was a greater effect for the low need group than was for the high need group. And so if you put it in cost effectiveness terms, it cost around £50,000, it would be the equivalent cost per extra ASCOT related quality over 1 year improvement of 1 point, and compare that to a £35,000 cost effectiveness figure equivalent for low moderate need. So if you take that data, the immediate implication is you ought to spend a little less on the high group and a little more on the low group. But obviously it's not quite as simple as that. So just want to end with a couple of ideas around
using cost-effective resource allocation in long-term care. And I think this is particularly relevant now because this is the way that policy is going in England. There is now a move to include cost-effectiveness information as far as possible in decisions about long-term care. And NICE, who I'm sure most of you are familiar with, have been charged with the responsibility of now developing guidelines in long-term care or social care, which at least take, as far as possible, cost-effectiveness information into account. Now, obviously, there's a huge healthcare literature on cost-effectiveness, but I think there are some specific issues when you apply that to a long-term care situation. And so I think, as such, it's not unreasonable to pose this question, and is it worth pursuing an outcomes-led cost-effectiveness agenda for social care, for resource allocation or commissioning decisions in social care or long-term care? And in that context, I would say there are these challenges that we have to deal with. And I hope these are mostly technical issues, but they are still there and they still need to be dealt with. So, for example, we still need to think a lot more about what our opportunity cost thresholds are in social care. As people familiar with the healthcare literature, NICE in England have tended to suggest a £20,000 to £30,000 opportunity cost threshold. We don't have anything like that as yet in social care or long-term care. There are challenges about how we identify best alternatives, because that, although it's a technical requirement, can make a big difference to the results that we get. There are we need to consider what the roles are for externalities, that is, you know, how the effects of service use flow out beyond the individual service user. There's huge issues around equity. Vulnerability weighting, or need weighting, that's another issue. So going back to those results I mentioned about the low and the high need group, there's some that would argue that you should weight high needs or the gaining quality of life for people with high needs at a higher degree than those for lower needs, now on a principle basis. And those are policy, ultimately I would say they're policy decisions, but they need to be made. And there's other impacts as well. What about the health impacts? In looking at long-term care, we tend to focus on quality of life and less so on mortality. But mortality, there is some suggestion that it is affected by long-term care services. So again, these things. So if you do introduce outcomes-led cost-effectiveness criteria, will that make a difference? I mean, that's a starting point to sort of answering the bigger question about whether it's worth it. And if you start from the premise it's an observation, in fact, it's not really a premise, that most care systems around the world work on a needs deficit basis. So you get allocated support because you have a deficit in your need, those systems don't generally take into account the opportunity cost of those decisions. And if you move to an outcomes-based cost-effectiveness system where you do take into account opportunity cost, then some initial results that we found, and that result that I presented earlier, show that there can be quite different allocations implied by those criteria. And you can generalise that, not only between the intensity or severity of need of allocation or targeting of your resources between different groups by severity, but also between different types of care, whether you focus on rehabilitation or reablement versus maintenance and so on. So there's lots of questions still to find answers for, but I would at least say that we are in a position now where ASCOT gives us a real tool for developing real measures of opportunity cost, and that will, I think, take us a long way forward in how we can improve the use of our long-term care budgets. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, questions? Any questions for Jules?
Yeah. You say that this has implications for NICE.
Yeah.
I always refer to nice as nasty.
Okay.
So do people in my neighbouring fields a bit.
Yeah.
We are aware that nice has thresholds, yes. You say that nice has not, although nice has actually started to take responsibility for this,
yeah.
You suggest that the question of what metrics nice might use is still open to negotiation.
I don't know if they'd agree, but that's my view.
Do you think that this is as amenable, these issues are as amenable to nice procedures as, for example, the testing of a treatment for, let's say, a certain kind of child brain cancer, just to keep it nice and topical? Or is this actually something where, because you rightly raised quite a lot of questions, actually we can't do nice type analysis in any case, and this remains a wicked problem?
I'm a health economist, so you think I would be naturally biased towards this, saying, "Oh yeah, we can certainly do this," but I'm not. I mean, I pose that question, and I pose it at the end in all good faith, because I'm still not entirely convinced. I think the problems are significant. I would say that, and I'm sure that NICE would agree, that you would never use this information in any sort of dogmatic way, and certainly not for long-term care. So, I mean, it's going to help your resource allocation decisions if you know that intervention A in long-term care is twice as cost-effective as intervention B. That's not to say that you would just fund intervention A, but it's an added piece of information in the arsenal of the decision-maker that they have that information. Now, if we can do as good a job as possible to make that accurate, then that, I think, is going to be a step forward. But it is a costly thing to do. I mean, all this work, the evidence base you'd have to build up, is not a trivial undertaking by any means. It brings me on to another kind of pet subject of mine, which is, if you look at... sorry, I'm taking up loads of time.
It's fine.
Okay. You should stop me.
Right.
I will...
One more minute then.
So, if you look at healthcare, what tends to happen is that the providers, and particularly the pharmaceutical companies, they're the ones that pay for the studies. So they want to, they market technically, they think that they've got a cost-effective product. In long-term care, providers don't do that. And most of the studies on this get funded by government. And I think that will, I mean, one of the things that will potentially happen nicely on this new remit is that the long-term care providers will wake up and start to realise that actually if their product, it's a bit of a stark term, but what they're offering to service users, it is not at all cost-effective, or really doesn't have great impact on the quality of life of people using those services, then, you know, that's an issue. So, I've sat on the fence in truth.
Well, I once worked for a research institute in Australia that was supposed to evaluate government labour market policy evaluations. Mm-hmm. And I said to my colleagues there, we are plaiting the rope with which we hang ourselves. And indeed, the next thing that happened was that this organisation was closed down.
Yeah. Well, it may be the case, but that's why, you know, the role for there is always going to be a role for the public sector in developing standards.
Brilliant. Thank you, Joseph.